Hey, welcome to the Protectors Podcast. And as usual, we have talked about 20 minutes before we hit the record button. Hey, welcome to the show, Michael. How you doing?
I'm going to give you that 20 minutes before we talk. Hello. Hey, Jason, how are you? Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Who's this guy? We weren't just talking about like St. Pete and Miami and Tallahassee and Florida parks and Amazon and thrillers and this and that. Yeah. No, I dig Florida. You know, I'm kind of torn though, because one of my friends has me really kind of getting into the cooler weather, you know, and not so much that humidity. Cause I tell you, man, the humidity down there is about to go like, well, you know what? Let me hear from you. You're like the native Miamian, Floridian. What is that humidity really like for us East Coast, you know, Northeast Coast people?
You're going to have to just butch up. I mean, I was born and raised in Miami, and I remember as a child and growing up, as I got older, when the summer starts to hit, you kind of go through like a 2 or 3 day period of like really sweltering feeling and times. And then you get used to it because you're already kind of acclimated to it. It's when people come down and get off an airplane and they're not used to it, that they have trouble with it. And also with the advent of technology, air conditioning and such, Florida's become a lot more palatable place to be. But what we also see is what they commonly call Las Vegas throat. When people go in and out of Las Vegas and the hotels are constantly air conditioning and heat, and they get sick. So when you come down and you're not used to being in the air conditioner and not used to being in the balmy, warm weather, your body's going to have some issues at first.
I tell you, I always thought about, like, cause I was law enforcement in San Diego. It wasn't humid. It was like a really dry heat. Mm-hmm. Now you're in LEO. It's the 80s and the 90s. We're not quite up to the dry fit generation. You're rolling around with your button up shirt. You're doing the undercover work. Let's equate the heat into this factor now. The heat, and then you got to carry all this, like, you know, your pistol, your ammo, your cuffs, and you got to run around, and it's just sweltering. And let's talk about this before the dry fit generation.
Yeah, before the dry fit generation, I really didn't carry a lot of gear. We were pretty deep under. We had like hardcore standing rules that you did not enter the our UC locations with any gear or t-shirts or stuff. And I remember like teaching at the DEA, and they would always give me a polo shirt as I was leaving. Here's a polo shirt. And I'm like, I can't wear this. I never can wear this. But you just kind of dealt with it, you know. I was a younger man. I was, you know, and you just have a better proclivity to handling all that.
I don't think a lot of people understand like true undercover means being sans any thin blue line, any like looking like a cop, feeling like a cop, and get rid of all that generalization. Having the undercover warehouses, having the undercover storefronts, undercover locations. Now you started off as a regular police. And you don't just start off undercover. So how did you get into the undercover?
Actually, you know, my career path is a little different than most. And not because I was different. It's just that's how circumstances worked out. I came out of the police academy like everybody else. But I tell people when I teach classes that I was raised with money launderers and drug traffickers. And sometimes the road you choose to avoid your future, you find on that very same road. You know, that's where your destiny lies. And I had a very keen understanding of the drug culture, the drug world, the drug mentality, and money laundering. So my agency kind of tapped into that when I was even in the police academy. I was actually being pulled out of the academy once or twice to meet with people and talk to them. So I came out of the police academy. I did my mandatory 3 months of FTO training, field training officer training. I did one day on the road, and then I got pulled out to a plainclothes street narcotics task force. I did that for about 8 months and went back to the road for like another 6 months. And then I got put into Vice Intelligence Narcotics, the VIN unit, for 10 years. And then after that, it was back and forth between the roads and supervising. And actually ended up last 5 years of my career in a desk doing grants and acquisitions. So.
Now you mentioned Vice and you mentioned Miami. So, I mean, obviously we have to talk about that. We got to get the elephant out of the room right now.
Yeah.
the best 80s cop show out there. Very realistic.
Very realistic because they had great training people and technical advisors. They had some really good people on that show in the very first couple of years. People don't realize that, like, the first year of Hill Street Blues, all of those plot lines were from Miami Stories, and Hugh Peoples was a Miami-Dade police officer. He was a technical advisor for Hill Street Blues. That's why when the opening credit, you see the Chicago car kind of skid on the ice and says, take a call and Peoples drive. That's a little homage to him. So when Michael Mann and Anthony Yurkovich came down to Miami to do Miami Vice, we already had a mechanism of good people on hand to help out and get that series off to a good run and start. It was a highly stylized version of what we did. There are some similarities. Art and life do imitate each other from time to time, and we found ourselves many times in an atypical Miami Vice situation. But it's, once again, it's a highly stylized version of what we were doing.
I think a lot of people don't realize, like, the drug game is, it's a game, you know, in a way. It's like you have, it's like, I should say more like a puzzle, pieces of a puzzle and putting them together. There's so many different pieces of it, so many different people involved with it on both sides of the law. Now, that must have really worked into, like, you know, you're deciphering these cases, you're doing these cases, you're building these cases, you're living them there, you're learning them, you're learning how to do the affidavits, the subpoenas, the this and that and everything. So later on, when you start writing, it must have been a lot easier than just a regular layman picking up a pen to write about a protagonist like Cade Taylor. I had to read that real quick. Cade Taylor, I mean, obviously, you know, the undercover cop who's the main protagonist, but he has real life experience based on yours.
Yeah, I mean, there's the old adage, you write what you know. A lot of people wanted me to write a tell-all type book, and I just didn't feel like that was something that was going to be in my wheelhouse. So I wrote a fictional character, Cade Taylor, and he's currently in four different novels now. And we follow Cade as he navigates and maneuvers his way through this murky underworld of drugs and cocaine and money laundering in Miami. And people seem to like Cade Taylor quite a lot. There's quite a growing legion of Cade Taylor fans. The books are written in the first person, so many people feel like they're right with Cade as he goes about his daily activities. The thing I do with these four novels and the whenever future Cade Taylor novels there are, is I don't put him to rest. You wake up with him, you go to bed with him, you get up the next day. The books are very descriptive. I think we're living in a world now where many readers and many other people looking for entertainment mediums are very visual now. So the books are very descriptive. They're very accurate. They're geographically and chronologically accurate to South Florida. And it seems to be a fun journey and a good ride.
Now, the current one's Choices and Chances, right?
Current one is Choices and Chances. The first one was called Trust No One. And then the second one that came out after Trust No One was called Grasp and Smoke. The third one was One More Move. And the fourth one is now called Choices and Chances.
Now, the big thing, one of the reasons I love talking about authors, especially with like the realistic background of yours, or the real life background, is that transition from, you know, living on a street, being in a street, carrying the badge and gun, doing the job. And where does that creativity come from? Where does that spark that says, you know what, I want to create something?
I think the spark is always there. It's kind of dormant for a while. In Spanish, you know, they use the word chispa for spark, which basically means like an igniter. And I think what happens is, as you transition through your career, through your experiences, through just your age, that chispa, that spark gets ignited. And once it gets ignited, you have a choice. You can tamper it down and put it out. I wouldn't recommend doing that to any type of creative surge. Or you could let it run crazy and burn everything down. I wouldn't recommend that either. But if you can channel it into a control burn where it's beneficial for growth and beneficial for future development, then I think you're on the right path. And that's where a lot of people come to the crossroads of their life, where they become either an author, a painter, or even a musician. They start to pull from those experiences and channel it out to a digestible format that someone else can partake in, enjoy, and learn from. And I think I've hopefully done that with these four novels.
Now, that must feel really good to have. It's almost like I always talk about this, and I shouldn't say always say I always talk about this, but like the mission. Like your mission now is like it's a creative one. This keeps your mind, to me, it seems like it keeps your mind like free of going back and being like, oh, I wish I did this. I wish I did that. Now, when you're writing the books, you're like, okay, I could fix the past, some of the mistakes I've made and some of the things I wanted to readjust.
Yeah. Well, I wrote Trust No One and I thought that would be a one and done. And then there was such a hue and cry for more Kay Taylor that I wrote Grasp and Smoke. And then I started being asked by many people, when's the next one? When are you going to write the next one? And the answer is always the same. If I think, and I want to emphasize the word think, if I think I can tell a compelling, entertaining story, then I'll do it. I don't want to put something out there just to put something out there. I want the readers to have an engagement of enjoyment. And so far, I think we have that. And when I look at various metrics, social media, sales and everything else, I see an uptick in people everywhere from England to Australia, Canada, United States. Lots of people are really gravitating towards Kay Taylor, and Kay has captivated a lot of people. And I'm happy for that. I'm happy for them. It's nice to bring an escapism or a read-in journey for anyone who chooses to pick up the books.
It's one thing I'd like too is like you and I were talking before we hit record about there's a lot of military thrillers out there, but I'm telling you, it's really tough to find a cop book. A really solid cop book. I mean, yeah, we have the Reacher books. We have these books here and there, but this genre to me is way underdeveloped. And I think we need more Kay Taylors.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think Michael Connelly really opened that door with Harry Bosch. He helped a lot of people with that. And the problem, not the problem, but the issue at hand is that you would never tell a surgeon how to conduct an operation, nor would you bang on the cockpit door and tell the pilot to level off the trim tabs at, you know, you just wouldn't do that. But we've been exposed to law enforcement and the military so much in our lives that we seem to think we know it. And what many people are finding out when they pick up the Kay Taylor series of books is this is a whole aspect of law enforcement they were never exposed to. You don't learn cocaine trafficking and money laundering in the police academy. They'll teach you traffic stops. They'll teach you how to conduct an investigation for burglary or something like that. But they don't teach you how to be an undercover money launderer. So the thing with the military thrillers is that a lot of people have served in the military. So you as a military thriller author, you really need to be on your game because someone's going to call you out if you don't have the exact right weaponry, the exact right emblem on your uniform, the exact right number of a unit or a brigade. There's a lot of people out there looking to say, aha, you're wrong. And that happens in my genre as well. But very few people have the experiences I have of working undercover 10 years in the Medellin and Cali drug cartels. As a money launderer, therefore, I'm able to transpose some of that insight into these books.
Now, let's talk about the pucker factor then. You just brought it up, the undercover factor, you know, of going in. Your first real, I mean, yeah, I'm sure you've done Dubai Bus and you've done like a lot of the smaller time undercover leading up to like the big time. But when you started rolling into that, what was that like? What was that pucker factor like? Or was it just like a, you know, hey, you know what? I've dealt with this before. I'm just going to put it in the back of my mind.
You know, I think I may have been out of my mind, to be honest with you. We were working pretty fast and pretty, you know, we were doing things at a very quick pace. There wasn't a lot of time for reflection. And I oftentimes reconcile it with, it's like being in a hurricane. When you're in the center, everything's calm. The eye of a hurricane is very calm. It's everything that's swirling around you that's destructive. So it's when you step out of the eye and you look back and you realize, oh my gosh, what a mess, what a destructive mess that was. So we were always, when I say we, I had team members with me. We were always in the center and you have a lot of faith in yourself. You have faith in your teammates. You have faith in your equipment. You have faith in your training. And that is what's sustained me. I can't speak for them. That's what sustained me. Some days were high intensity and some days were low energy. It's the ebb and flow of the criminal curve. And we were not only, lassoed ourselves to it, but we were trying to corral it, control it, ride it, and also, you know, put it down as well at the same time.
Now, how do you put it down? I mean, how do you go from that life of like the adrenaline surges all the time to just like,
You just have to recognize that what your role is in that you're not judge, jury, and executioner. Your job is to enforce the law. And if you do something and for somewhere down the road, it doesn't work out the way you intended it, you just have to recognize you did your part of the equation. I lived in Miami, Florida, and, you know, there were lots of people you would see from time to time. And one of them was, I didn't know him. I didn't talk to him, but I would see, you know, O.J. Simpson. When he left California, went to Miami, I would see him coming out of a restaurant or something. And somebody would oftentimes say something about him. And my attitude was, he was tried by a jury. That's it. You know, you can't get attached to the outcome. You can't be that person. If you're going to drive yourself crazy, you can have your personal views, but you can't let your personal views affect the foundation of what we do as a justice system.
Now, when you bring up homicide, how did you transition from drugs into work in murder cases?
In the drug world, we oftentimes have a very high intensity, as I said earlier, way of doing things. And sometimes it's a little slow. And we had a serial murder case that we had an individual that we thought was a potential serial murderer come through our city, and the case fell on my lap. And I started working it, and I got very close to a forensic psychologist. And that psychologist became a mentor and a friend, and we worked the case together. And I then figured out that this was something I had an aptitude for, and I pursued it further and got a master's degree in it, and got accepted for a doctorate in the UK for it. And just started to parlay my experience, my abilities, and my motivation towards that. So I started working and consulting on some serial homicide cases.
Really like to know more about that, because you go from working these big cases, and you know, drug cases always have, they spider out. There's always more than one person. But when you're starting to talk about these cases and murder cases, you're looking at one person, and it's like you really can look into their mind. Because like when you're looking at a drug organization, for profit, a lot of people involved with it. Now you're looking at, you know, different types of crime, like a crime of passion or crime of revenge or some sort of psychosocial type thing where they're killing people, and getting into that mindset. That must have been like a neat experience to be able to, like, you're the hunter. You're trying to find someone who's deadly.
Well, I don't know if I'd use the word neat. I think I would just say that it is an experience.
Yeah, not neat. Yeah, I know. My words are a little off sometimes.
No. it is an experience. You know, the psychodynamics, I've been very fortunate. I've been incredibly blessed and very fortunate to work with some really, really good people. My agency sent me to some great schools, and I in turn turned around and tried to parlay that knowledge as best I could back out again as an instructor. But many of the larger, for lack of a better term, thinkers in the field I've been able to work with. And so I've been able to glean a lot of information from them and work with them. I don't know if it's challenging work. It's emotionally challenging, that's for sure. I don't get involved in anything unless I'm directly asked to do it. My wife will ask me something, and she'll say, "What do you think about this? What do you think about that?" And I'll say, "I'm really not keeping up on it." And she'll look at me kind of like, "Well, you know, why not?" Because I don't want to get emotionally attached into those cases. When you deal with those type of cases, you're not only dealing with the parameters of the actual homicides themselves. You're oftentimes dealing with surviving family members and things like that. And it's very hard. It's very hard. And I had one case of a serial murderer who was killing prostitutes in Miami just before a Super Bowl. And I had like every city manager, every mayor, every chamber of commerce person breathing down my neck because, you know, the Super Bowl was coming to town in 10 days. So there's a lot of political pressure that goes with some of these things as well. There's time constraints. There's financial constraints, budgetary limitations. There's a lot of plates spinning in the air.
I can't imagine the political ramifications of that, because it's death. And it, like I said, I shouldn't have said it's not neat, but I'm just saying the aspect of the investigation. But yeah, there's, when you start looking at, this is a loss of life. And then you have that whole sphere that goes around it with the family and friends, and they're putting pressure on the politicians, and everybody's putting pressure on you. And you're like, look, I can only follow the evidence so much. I can only pull as many strings as I possibly can that's out there. What, you know, that's one thing I want to get into, is like pulling these strings. How complex are these cases to really track them down?
Well, they're, I think they're harder now than they were 10 or 15, 20 years ago, because the media starts to get a hold of them. And at every turn, every corner, there's someone who's an ex-DIS, an ex-FBI, ex-something, who's telling you pretty much textbook, you know, first paragraph information. And the media and the public pick up on that, and they expect results. We watch shows like CSI Miami and CSI itself and all these other shows, and people think that forensics are, everyone's got a $17 million a lab at their disposal, and everyone has all these tools and these great gadgets. And it's not that simple. You still have to go in front of a jury, and all that jury has to have is a shred of doubt, and the whole case is gone. And the juries now watch these TV shows, and they expect law enforcement to come forward with all this compelling evidence. And that's not how it is all the time. So you're dealing with perception, and you're dealing with reality, and you have to stay in the focus of your reality, because the perception of what you're doing and how you're doing it is totally different. Hollywood likes to make the criminal profiler look as if they have some sort of psychic vision, some sort of keen insight to behavioral aspects that the average person doesn't have. And do they? Yeah, they do to a point. But we don't get green flashes of imagery that flash across our brain and hear and see things that the average person doesn't see. Actually, the truth of the matter is, it's a lot of it's rooted in the science. It's rooted in mathematics. It's rooted in probability. It's deductive logic. It kind of all has to come together.
Now that brings us back to Cade Taylor. What kind of crimes is Cade Taylor? We know he's in a drug world. He's in and out of that. Is he going after the bad guys, the serial killers?
Well, he hasn't. I can't say he has of yet, and that's not to be designed as a teaser, just meant to say that the door is always open in the future. And these four novels that have come out so far, Cade Taylor is a vice intelligence narcotic detective in Miami, Florida. He's working with the DEA. He's working with the U.S. Customs Service. He's also working his own drug type cases, and he finds himself in all four of these novels vexed with certain different situations. The best thing so far is that if you read these four novels in order, it's great. If you read them standalone, it's just as great. The books aren't spoilers. They can all stand alone, but when you read them together, you see the thread of continuity between Cade and some of the people he works with and deals with. You see the evolution of their relationships a little bit. But if you should read any of these books out of order, you will not be lost, and you will not be have the other three books ruined for you. Each one can stand on their own.
I really like the time frame too of the 1990s, late 1990s, because you don't have the smartphones. You don't have the GPSs. You're rolling around with like Thomas guides and maps, and you're trying to find people like when you don't have satellites and this and that. So I really dig this time frame as well.
Yeah, the books are written in 1998. And like you just said, the books are very accurate to the times. They're accurate to South Florida, both geographically and chronologically. In fact, in the book Grasp and Smoke, at one point, one of the investigators, a homicide investigator, pulls out her cell phone. And I had to do my homework and realize that cell phone cameras did not come out for another 45 days from when that scene took place. So I had to switch it to a Polaroid camera. So I work very hard. I do a lot of research. I study moon phases and tidal charts. And when they order from a restaurant, they don't just order an entree. They order the exact entree from that menu at a restaurant. Everywhere they go, streets they drive on, places they go, things they do are all truly accurate physical locations in Miami. And some people like to read my books with Google Maps open, and they can actually see what I'm describing to them in the books. And I think, once again, going back to Michael Connelly, I think he did Los Angeles a great service, because as Harry Bosch travels to LA, a lot of those places are accurate as well.
I love that idea too. And that's a lot of your law enforcement background is showing up in your pages, not just by cases and stuff, but by the granularity, come up with a word like that, the granular nation of notion. You know what?
I'm the not granular even aspect.
Actually, we're going to leave this in. I'm not editing that out because, hey, I'm a doctor, right? Yeah, go figure. No, but that's the thing is like, it's like writing a report that a jury's going to have to see, that everybody's going to have to see. And you're going to be like, huh, okay. It has to be correct. Yeah. I love that aspect of it.
It's very accurate. One of the heartburns we had watching Burn Notice, Miami Vice and such was that we would see them make a left-hand turn on the street and they'd end up 6 miles away. People who lived in Miami would know that. So I made an intentional aspect to make these books chronologically and geographically accurate. In fact, it was my editor who, after like the second novel, she's like, I get it. She goes, this is how Cade Taylor processes things. As he's driving and going in and out of offices and businesses and restaurants, he's always thinking about stuff. And this is how he processes the world. And you see that with him. And many people, there's always kind of a surprise element with the Cade Taylor novels because people are with Cade from start to finish. And then when something hits, they never see it coming. And then upon reflection, they see that all the breadcrumbs have been lined up all along. You just missed it. And that's once again, comes back to the investigative mind right in the novel. The investigative mind's not reading the novel. So many readers have these great aha moments because when it finally becomes crystal clear what's going on or what they're seeing or what they're looking for, they realize that the clues were in front of them the whole time.
I love it, man. I really do. I'm actually going to pick this up as soon as we get off of here. Cool. Through your QR code on your website.
All right.
So I'm going to start one of, and I typically never read books because I never have time. I'm always on the Audible and stuff like that. But for once, I want to just sit down and read a book. Take some damn time and read a book. You know that?
You know, it's.
I'm retired. What am I doing?
It's hard for people to read books between taking care of children, taking care of parents, taking care of your job. And then all of the electronic, I won't say intrusions, I'll just say the electronic things at your disposal, cell phones, TVs, iPads, computers. It's very hard for people to like, keep that attention span. I will say this, and this is not a lecture. The Cade Taylor books are designed to like be read. If you try to read the book and put it down and come back to like 6 months later, you'll miss a lot because there's a lot that's said and done in these books that are once again in plain sight. You're just missing it until it hits you in the head like a hammer.
I think I'm going to take my own advice and, you know, go for a walk, put my ruck on, go for a walk, leave my electronics behind and stop and just read for a bit. You know, I mean, you got to get out there and read these books. But Mike, I really appreciate you coming on the show and I look forward to having you back on.
Yeah, Jason, this has been a pleasure.